Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 12th of November, these are our main stories. Dark powers push me out, says Bolivia's former president. Not so, says the opposition. In Australia, fires near Sydney have led to hundreds of schools being closed and widespread evacuations. And the man who helped set up the White Helmet Medics in Syria is found dead. Also in this podcast...
The fact that these are compounds that people are inhaling and we don't know about their safety is a big problem.
New research shows that e-cigarette use takes a serious toll on heart health. Resist the dark powers that forced my resignation. That's the message from Bolivia's former president, Evo Morales, to his supporters. And they seem to have taken that message on board. Again, they've clashed with the police and at least 20 people were injured in the cities of La Paz and El Alto. Mr. Morales resigned on Sunday after being urged to do so by the military. He called it a coup, but his main opponent in the recent contested election, Carlos Mesa, says it was the will of the people who'd been out on the streets for days, calling on him to step down.
It's a lie, because the President Morales resigned because the Bolivian people in a pacific and democratic resistance work in the streets in peace and in democratic spirit to resist the immense and giant fraud against the Bolivian people.
Well, a few hours before we recorded this podcast, Mr. Morales was offered asylum by Mexico. I asked our correspondent Katie Watson, who's in charge in Bolivia now.
As we were at the barricades in the centre of La Paz, there was a police convoy and people cheering the police through. And the convoy had Jeanine Agnes Chavez in the car. Now, she's the Senate's second vice president, because the issue of this vacuum of power, which concerned a lot of people, was because the vice president resigned, as well as Evo Morales, as did the president of the Senate, as did the head of the lower house. So at that point, nobody really knew who's in charge. But the politician, Agnes, has said that she will assume the presidency. And as we were there, she was driving through to try and get sworn in. So it's moving again. It's moving fast here in Bolivia. We still haven't heard when there will be elections. But nevertheless, people on the streets were pretty excited. Well, of course, those were the people who oppose Evo Morales.
Indeed, and it's hard to overestimate the importance of the military in all this. Them staying with the opposition and against Evo Morales is crucial, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think this is where the concern's been, as Evo Morales was a man who did great things here in Bolivia in terms of social inclusion, in terms of economic growth, but his democratic record was certainly called into question in the later years. And I think that's where, you know, people were concerned about, you know, what that meant for democracy. And then you see all the military saying that they needed him to resign. And it got some people nervous. People who support a change in government say that they're only doing what they needed to do to make sure democracy was, you know, maintained in Bolivia. Others, of course, have called it a coup.
Katie Watson in La Paz. Many people in New South Wales have woken up to what are being called catastrophic fire conditions. It could be the most dangerous week for bushfires in Australia's history. Temperatures are expected to soar to more than 35 degrees Celsius in parts of the region, and strong winds are going to make the conditions across the state even more dangerous and unpredictable. Rob Rogers is New South Wales Rural Fire Service Deputy Commissioner.
There's a lot of these fires that have been burning for weeks now, and you've got more than a million hectares of this that's alight still. And our concern is for the people that are in front of these fires. If we think back to last Friday, what those fires did, they were spotted ahead, sometimes 6, 12 kilometres ahead of themselves, started new fires. So their capacity for these fires to move rapidly is absolutely extreme.
For more, I spoke to our correspondent Phil Mercer, who's in Maitland in the Hunter Valley, north of Sydney.
We have an emergency declaration here in New South Wales. This gives fire authorities the power to turn off electricity, to organise evacuations. We're actually driving through Maitland. This is quite a big centre, about 165 miles to the north of Sydney, and there is a discernible smoky haze in the air. You can smell the smoke. We're just driving into one of the main streets now, and clearly people are trying to get on with their daily lives, but there is an undeniable sense that vast areas of New South Wales are now under this catastrophic fire warning. So understandably a sense of unease, and many people on edge as they look and wonder where these fires in this particular part of eastern Australia will flare. We've just been at an emergency command centre, and they are trying to organise all the assets they need, the firefighters, the water bombing aircraft, to fight these fires on what will be a very hot day here. Temperatures expected to soar to 38 degrees Celsius, very strong winds predicted too, and also conditions underfoot bone dry because of a long-standing drought.
And briefly, Phil, people are being urged to evacuate their homes, and indeed the fire services have the power to force them to do that, but where do people go? That's the dilemma, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, when that emergency warning was issued 24 to 36 hours ago, people in bushfire prone areas were urged to leave, even if it was just to go to a built up area, to a shopping centre. And that really does underscore how dangerous it is. Essentially, the authorities saying, get out, we don't really care where you go as long as you are not in the line of fire. The New South Wales State Premier Gladys Berejiklian said to people, and I quote her, she said, "For heaven's sake, stay away from bushland during these very dangerous times."
That was Phil Mercer. Well, tales of heroism have also emerged from all this. Petra has a home in Maxville in New South Wales, which is about 500 kilometres from Sydney. On Friday, she told the BBC she was worried she had lost her home. Earlier, she spoke about what had happened when she did eventually manage to get to her property.
"When I arrived, I wasn't allowed in because police had been called down. There'd been a fatality, and I had no idea when, but by the time they came back out, I drove 30 k's to my place from the roadblock, and as I was driving through, I could not believe the cataclysmic sight I was seeing. And as I got closer to my house, there's absolutely no way in the world my place is going to survive this, because every house I saw had been burnt to the ground. All the bush had been burnt to the ground. It was incinerated. It was a really Armageddon sort of paysage. And when I got to my house, again, I thought, there's no way in the world. And I kept creeping up, waiting for the worst. And I came around the bend and I saw my house was intact. And I was telling myself, oh no, that's a, you know, surely the back half is going to be half burnt out, or the side, or I'm going to find a shell there. And I went right around my house and I found just my veranda had been burnt. The fire had come right up to the house in every which way and had gotten onto the veranda but had stopped. This was a mystery to me. And then I found out that my neighbour, he had actually snuck back the night before, just a few hours after everyone had been evacuated. He went back in when he felt the fire had gone through, even though it was still blazing all over the place. He saw my house on fire and he put it out. My heroic neighbour saved my house."
That was an amazing story of Petra, whose house was saved by her neighbour in Maxville in New South Wales. For 5 years now, the volunteer doctors and nurses that make up the White Helmets have provided what's often been the only medical help for thousands of people caught up in opposition-held areas of Syria. Now, a former British Army officer who helped set up the group has been found dead in Turkey. The body of James Lemessurier was discovered outside his home in Istanbul. It's not yet known how he died. The White Helmets were nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, but the Syrian regime says its volunteers are aiding terrorists. Just last week, Russia, who support President Assad, accused James Lemessurier of being a British spy. Well, Mr. Lemessurier spoke to the BBC in July last year.
"There has been much propaganda against the White Helmets. Inside Syria, they very much push the narrative that the White Helmets are a Western organisation, that they are a front for the intelligence services, and that's to create divisions inside the country and to make life more difficult for them. And at the same time, externally in Europe, they push the narrative that the White Helmets are Al-Qaeda and are terrorists. And this is clearly propaganda. I don't think there can be any doubt about the extraordinary efforts that the White Helmets have made."
Hamish de Breton-Gordon is a director of the Doctors Under Fire campaign group, which has worked extensively in Syria. And he was a friend of James Lemessurier. T. Tim Franks asked him what he understands about Mr. Lemessurier's death.
It's certainly suspicious. I was informed early this morning that James had died, wasn't quite sure of the details. Then more details have come out that he appears to have fallen off the balcony at his house in Istanbul. But why that happened, who knows? I was with him fairly recently and he seemed fine to me, as though there wasn't anything, you know, particularly troubling him that I knew of. But of course, the Russian Foreign Ministry accused him of being an MI6 agent only a couple of days ago. So there is a lot of strange things here. And I hope the Turkish authorities will do a really thorough investigation so we can find out exactly what happened.
So you're saying the last time you saw him, you didn't think that he was sort of feeling depressed or mentally unwell. Did he say anything to you about feeling under threat?
Not really. I mean, we discussed quite a lot about security matters. Obviously, operating in the region and that area, one always has to be very concerned about them. And I think he was very detailed about that. And the other thing I think that is significant is the huge amount of, you know, abuse and trolling that James and the White Helmet get from Russian bots and Syrian bots, which is, you know, is legion. It's like a, you know, a fire hydrant of this abuse all the time. And, you know, it's shocking even today hearing these dreadful people rejoicing in his death. So that must affect people in some way.
But as you say, it went beyond trolls and bots. We had this statement just a few days ago from the spokeswoman of the Russian Foreign Ministry saying that James Lemessurier was a former MI6 agent and that he had known links to terrorist groups. And this was often the charge. I mean, this has long been the charge against the White Helmets, is that they were abetting either deliberately or unwittingly jihadist groups inside Syria.
But a ridiculous statement for somebody to claim that he is both an MI6 agent and an Al-Qaeda operative is contradictory and absolutely ridiculous. And I think Karen Pierce, our UN rep, only very recently has clearly stated that James was not a British security operative. The claim that the White Helmets work with Al-Qaeda and jihadi groups, to my mind, again, it is crazy. I have been in Syria investigating chemical weapons attacks myself, which allegedly had something to do with the White Helmets, and absolutely not. I didn't see any White Helmets. I only saw chlorine barrel bombs being dropped by Syrian helicopters. So you can't make sure that 100%, you know, don't in some way get involved with some jihadi groups. But I know that James was assiduous about this. Everybody signed a moratorium that they were purely there as first responders. And all I saw, that was absolutely the case. It's just this propaganda, fake news, disinformation that we see pouring out of Syria and some of its allies to try and discredit what is a fantastic organisation. And James did a fantastic job setting it up.
That was Hamish de Bretton-Gordon. E-cigarettes are marketed by tobacco companies as the far safer alternative to normal cigarettes. As one of the biggest companies, Philip Morris, puts it on its website, smoking-related diseases such as lung cancer, cardiovascular disease and emphysema are caused primarily by inhaling harmful compounds formed when tobacco is burned, not by nicotine. But a report just published by the American Heart Association says that e-cigarette use takes a serious toll on heart health. Dr. Rosemary Robertson is Deputy Chief Science and Medical Officer of the American Heart Association. She says e-cigarettes are not as safe as people think or as the industry suggests.
In these studies, people who were smoking e-cigarettes, when they compared those to people who were not using e-cigarettes, had a less healthy response in terms of blood flow to the heart. These are small studies, but the fact that that could be seen at all was really quite dramatic. We can't be certain of the mechanisms by which that blood flow is decreased, but we do know from studies done looking at the cells, for example, that help our blood vessels widen up when we need more blood flow, that a number of the compounds that are present in e-cigarettes can seriously diminish the ability of those cells to work properly. The fact that we don't know what the long-term risks are of e-cigarettes is our call to be cautious. The reason we're so concerned about what the long-term risks might be is past history. when women were encouraged to smoke more than 50 years ago, it took a very long time before lung cancers in women began to catch up with those in men. It took decades, but very clearly they posed a huge risk. So the fact that we have no longitudinal studies and that these are compounds that people are inhaling and we don't know about their safety is a big problem.
Dr. Rose Marie Robertson. Still to come on this podcast. Commemorative events have been taking place around the world to mark the signing of the armistice to end the First World War. To the United States now, and this week marks what could turn out to be a pivotal week for Donald Trump and his presidency. Top of the list is the public impeachment hearings, which begin on Wednesday. Before that, we're expecting to see a second transcript of a phone call between President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine and Mr. Trump, which is the basis of the impeachment investigations. We can hear now from a man who has been at the heart of American foreign policy as Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush, Ambassador Nicholas Burns. He's now at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Razia Iqbal asked him if it was a big week in the Trump presidency.
It's a transformational week because until now, people have been testifying in private, and we've just had leaks of the testimony and now transcripts. The American public and the world will now see Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, Ambassador Bill Taylor. These are American diplomats currently serving who will testify that they saw things in the Ukraine scandal that worried them and that they think were irregular, and it's going to be dramatic. And it'll have a decisive impact, I think, on whether the American people want to go forward with impeachment or not.
When you say you think it'll have a decisive impact, the context in which all of this takes place, of course, is that President Trump continues to tweet against people like Bill Taylor and even somebody who he appointed, Gordon Sondland, the US ambassador to Ukraine. This whole sense that the president can, in one tweet, negate the work of State Department officials. What do you make of that?
I think it's objectionable. I mean, what you're seeing is from President Trump, diversionary tactics. He's trying to get us to look everywhere, but at the central issue. Did he seek to extort the Ukrainian government to tell them that they had to investigate Joe Biden or else they wouldn't get their $391 million in military assistance? That's the heart of the issue. We've never had an American president do that in our memory, anything close to that. And if it can be proven that the president did that, then I think will lead to the president's impeachment by the House of Representatives. But of course, you know, in our system, then it goes to a trial in the Senate, and the Senate has a majority of Republicans in it.
And there would need to be at least 20 senators who vote against the president for that
That's
to
right.
go forward. I just wonder what you make of the impact of the vilification of State Department employees, people like Bill Taylor, who have served both under Republican and Democrat presidents, the impact of that on American diplomacy abroad.
I think it's been devastating. The fact that you've had these career officials, nonpartisan in our system, both military and civilian, come forward and testify to the truth and then to be attacked by the president and the president's acolytes, it's dispiriting for people within the federal government. We in the United States, our federal officials, take an oath not to the president, but to the Constitution. It's been like that since 1789. These people have stepped forward, and in my view, they've been, if there's a silver lining in this very dark cloud, they've been the silver lining because they've been so honorable, so nonpartisan in the way they've acquitted themselves, and yet they're subjected to this vilification, the president trying to make our government, the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, into public enemy number one, when that, of course, is entirely not the truth.
That was the Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush, Ambassador Nicholas Burns. Denmark is introducing random border controls with Sweden from Tuesday to combat organised crime. The move follows a number of attacks in Denmark this year, in which Swedes are the prime suspects. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Denmark has been rattled by recent violence. In August, industrial explosives wrecked the entrance to the Danish tax agency in Copenhagen, and there were two killings in a suburb of the Danish capital in June. Denmark is holding seven Swedish suspects. Sweden has approved the new measures. They'll be enforced on the Öresund rail bridge connecting Copenhagen and Malmö in Sweden and at four ferry ports. Danish police are setting up an Öresund border centre to collect intelligence on known criminals, their vehicles and associates. The thousands of daily commuters are advised to carry passports.
Mike Sanders. In screen entertainment, this decade's undoubted success story has been Netflix. The online streaming giant is now seen in 60% of American homes, and its hit film The Irishman has just opened in cinemas before it streams online. But this week, Disney rolls out its own streaming service, and Apple TV Plus recently launched too. So, is Netflix about to lose a big chunk of a very profitable market? Our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd, reports.
1980s set sci-fi Stranger Things is Netflix's current smash hit. Season 3 has been streamed in 64 million homes.
99 out of 100 times, kid goes missing. The kid is with a parent or a relative.
What about the other time? The one!
But this week, the mighty Disney is launching its streaming platform, Disney Plus.
Nothing will stand in our way.
With a huge and familiar catalogue to exploit, from Mary Poppins to Star Wars, Disney will cause even market leader Netflix to sweat. Jesse Whittock writes for Broadcaster magazine in London.
Disney, NBC Universal and the likes have decided that they need to get in on streaming, and they've created their own international services. We've had Apple TV Plus launch. Disney Plus is Disney's big play for the future of global media. They've looked at the Netflix model. They've seen that there is a huge opportunity in subscription. They have spent the best part of the last 10 years acquiring big media properties. They bought Lucasfilm, so they would have Star Wars. They bought Pixar, the Marvel Universe, things like that. They bought the Fox studio, so they've got even more firepower in that space to really muscle in on the Netflix business model.
Historically, Disney's been associated with family entertainment, like the new Frozen 2.
Elsa, the past is not what it seems.
Disney's now bringing almost all content it controls back in-house, ending licensing deals with companies now seen as rivals. Gina Keating wrote a book analysing the way Netflix grew until now.
They're being locked out of the content market by Disney, by all the studios who are starting their own streaming services now. So as their deals with those studios expire for things like the Marvel movies, Star Wars, Netflix has to replace those with something that it itself owns. And it's got to throw a lot of money at that. And on the international side, it has to go into countries that it has established itself to create domestic content, because in a lot of countries, people aren't really that interested in English-speaking content.
There's a better way to rent movies. As many as you want for only $17.99 a month and no late fees. Go to Netflix.com.
Netflix has come a long way from its old business of mailing out rental DVDs, though that does still operate. The move into streaming worked. More than a decade on, Disney can't be certain its move into online distribution will emulate that success. But Jesse Whittock says Netflix is also entering less certain times.
They have a huge debt pile, which they are adding to in order to continue creating new shows. They're also losing lots of shows like Friends. Having said that, they have such a strong position in the market at the moment that it's hard to see them crashing and burning. So it's on the new entrants to eat into Netflix's market. It's not the other way around. If Netflix carries on the way it is, it's big enough that it won't fail financially, and it's got enough control of the market that it can continue in that space. So it's on Disney, it's on Apple, it's on NBC, and it's on HBO Max to make that happen.
Vincent Dowd reporting. Let's end this podcast with some of the events taking place around the world to mark the 100th Armistice Day. Monday marked 100 years since the first Remembrance Day commemorated the more than 15 million soldiers and civilians who died in the First World War. The UK, France and the United States have been marking the end of hostilities between the Allies and Germany in World War I and in other conflicts too. Many people in Britain fell silent for 2 minutes on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month to remember the fallen. In the US, President Trump attended a Veterans Day event in New York.
To each veteran of the war, the glory of your deeds will only grow greater with time. This city is graced by your presence. This nation is forever in your debt, and we thank you all.
And in the French capital, Paris, French horse guards paraded up the Champs-Élysées to the Arc de Triomphe, where Emmanuel Macron, the president, led events attended by wartime veterans. Some of the celebrations taking place to commemorate Armistice Day, 100 years on. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.